Hey, it's Cameron here. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, and welcome to Ones and Twos, FP's economics podcast. Every week, we use data to try to explain the world. I'm Cameron Abadi, FP's deputy editor with you in Berlin, Germany. As always, Adam Tooze, FP's economics columnist and Columbia University professor, is with us, this time also with me in Berlin. So hi, Adam.
Hi, Cam.
We're not in the same room. Adam has a very busy schedule, so it feels much the same, even though we're in the same town. But first, the data point here is 4%. That is the share of Americans who say that they regularly think about the Iraq War, the war that the United States waged in Iraq 20 years ago. So those 20 years ago when the war was starting, it was seemingly all that anyone in the world could think about.
The ayes are 77, the nays are 23. The joint resolution is passed.
2003 global protests against the looming U.S. invasion of Iraq, the largest in history.
U.S. warships and planes launched the opening salvo of Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Of course, hundreds of thousands of people died in Iraq, and the political consequences seemed pretty dramatic at the time, with Barack Obama and Donald Trump both earning prominence eventually as critics of the war. But we thought we'd see if there's an economic lens that can provide some enlightenment on this 20-year anniversary. So, Adam, when all is said and done, what exactly did the Iraq War cost? And how should we go about even calculating that cost in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a grim toll to add up. I mean, the Brown University has a unit which did, you know, persistent, dogged, heroic work in adding up the numbers of the global war on terror. You alluded to the hundreds of thousands killed. I mean, the best estimate, I think, of Iraqis killed by US, the action of the US military and its allies, of course, notably Britain, is, you know, somewhere between 280 and 311,000 Iraqis were killed. Several times as many died as a result of the destruction of the Iraqi state. And if you add in the disruption in Syria that followed and that was directly connected to it through the sort of, the ISIS insurgency, the cost becomes even more exorbitant. Millions of people were displaced. About 3 million Iraqis were refugees in their own country at the worst moments of chaos. On top of that, the US military suffered 4,600 dead, another 3,700 lethal casualties amongst US contractors, 32,000 wounded, 1,500 suffered amputations. This is just on the American side. I mean, it's in my view one of the great international crimes of the 21st century, and the fact that Bush and Blair never had to answer for their decision making before The Hague is, you know, one of the great omissions, failures of international justice. And I think the undermining of political legitimacy that followed from this, the fact that there really was no accountability for this disaster, has to be numbered amongst the costs. If we go to the bit which we can account for most directly, it's if you look at US military spending, the direct cost is something estimated in the order of $1.79 trillion. And if you add in the US veteran medical and disability care numbers, the figures go to $2.89 trillion. So it's an absolutely gigantic expenditure of money. Some element of that is the extra interest burden on the debt that was accumulated at the time, but the vast majority of it is expenditure. And those numbers don't include the spending by US allies, which would add, another 170 plus billion on top of that. So we're talking about a huge allocation of public funds to a war that was, in geopolitical terms, in human terms, in political terms, ruinous. It's really one of the great miscarriages of government in the modern era.
Trillions of dollars. First of all, we don't hear about trillions so much, I feel like, in our public policy. That's something like we've talked about, Adam, as potentially a future essay you write for Foreign Policy, just that the scale is something that we're usually talking about billions of dollars. But yeah, when you add it all up, often we're left with these sums in the trillions.
You know, perhaps the most devastating remark is simply that this was the one thing that the increasingly polarized and divided American political system could agree on doing. With very few notable exceptions, Barack Obama being one as a young senator, the American political system rallied of all projects, not around healthcare, not around, you know, a green energy transition, not around just basic infrastructure in the United States, but around this as the common project. And I think that's ultimately the most devastating conclusion that one reaches when looking at these numbers.
To get more into the details, what exactly is the legacy of the war in terms of military spending? Was there a peace dividend after the war was over? Or have we kept the kind of elevated military spending that we had during the war, but just sort of dropped any expectation that the military will be used for democracy promotion, as the term was during the Iraq War?
Well, you know, the budgetary accounting for the Pentagon is very complicated and quite opaque. But there is a basic division between warfighting expenditure, which peaked in 2008. That was on both Iraq and Afghanistan, when both, as it were, the Iraq surge was coming off its peak and the early Obama Afghanistan surge was building up in 2008, 2009. So the warfighting element sort of peaks at $200 billion and has fallen to a residual amount today. So there in the dedicated funds for overseas operations, you do see, as it were, the conjuncture of the war played out. But the longer term effects are seen in the what's called the DoD base budget, which also follows this pattern, but over a longer period and never comes down. So the base budget, which is driven by, you know, the number of personnel, the level of pay, which was raised in the early 2000s in the early stages of the global war of terror, so as to enable recruitment and then to hold the personnel, the expenditure on housing, expenditure on military health, all of that, as it were, feeds slowly through the system. The base budget peaked at about $700 billion early on in the Obama administration, then fell in the later stages of the Obama administration by $100 billion, and then surged from the first year of the Trump administration and has now reached, you know, new historic highs, well over $800 billion a year. And what we have also seen is that Congress increasingly outdoes itself in actually voting more funds for the Pentagon than the administration actually asks for. So fairly routinely since the outbreak of the war, there has been this snowballing effect where the military budget creaks upwards rather than downwards to respond to that sense of popular, you know, rallying around the flag. So by comparison with the 1990s period, where the Clinton administration really did take the peace dividend on a substantial scale, really we haven't seen anything like that in this case. We've also seen, of course, a major shifting of gears from the kind of war that the American military was fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, which was a, you know, counterinsurgency war, which required boots on the ground. What we're now seeing, of course, is a shifting of gear towards more high-tech programs, which are more suitable for confronting China, which is seen as the you know, the pace-setting threat, as the Pentagon likes to call it. So all of those things are running through those numbers, but on the whole, the DoD budget has moved on a slightly different cycle from the warfighting budget, and the DoD one oscillates around a two high levels, and they're the $700 billion level down to $600 and now back up from there, and really the sky's the limit at this point, I think.
Okay, we're going to take a break and come back, talk about the Iraqi economy itself.
Hi, ones and twos listeners, Rob Sachs here. I'm one of the show's producers, and I'm here to tell you a little bit more about one of our sponsors, BetterHelp. So springtime is here, and if you're like me, you're ready to get out and hang out with some friends and family a little bit more. But sometimes going out can get a bit overwhelming, especially if your social battery is feeling drained. If this is the case, therapy can be a great way to help keep your social battery well charged. Having someone who can assess your concerns and give you perspective can make all the difference in the world and give the boost you need to feel mentally prepared to go out and be your best self. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you gotta do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched up with a licensed therapist, and you can swap therapists at any time for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/onestwos, that's T-O-O-Z-E twos, today to get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/onestwos. Hi, ones and twos listeners. I'm Rob Sachs, one of the producers here at Foreign Policy. So here's a little secret I want to let you all in on. Almost all of our audio production is done from our laptops. Each day, our team is connecting with people from around the world, swapping audio files and scripts and everything we need to assemble the podcast you hear on Foreign Policy. Having secure and reliable data is our lifeblood, and I'm sure it is for many of you as well, which is why we're excited to tell you about CrashPlan. It's a service that offers unlimited computer backup for individuals and businesses at an affordable rate. It's quietly humming along in the background while you work, encrypting and sending all your new or changed files up to their secure cloud every 15 minutes. So if anything should happen, it's no problem. Your backup is just a few clicks away. So for sound peace of mind, consider CrashPlan. And now you have the opportunity to support us when you do it. Go to CrashPlan.com/ones for 50% off your first year of CrashPlan. That's CrashPlan.com/ones for 50% off your first year.
Hi, and welcome back. To turn to the Iraqi economy itself, it turns out the Iraqi economy was struggling long before the war. If you get into the numbers, it was not doing well before the invasion. But did the war do anything to change its trajectory or even improve it? Or is there any data on how the war has affected the overall Iraqi economy? And are there any lessons to be drawn about development policy from this overall experience?
Yeah, I kept coming away from, you know, doing the research for this question, I felt we should maybe come back to this as a separate segment to really address the state of, you know, Iraq as one of the weaker members of the OPEC system, as a neighbor of Syria, as a rival with Iran. We've spoken about Iran and Syria at various points, but I think it would be really an interesting and important story to go back to because it's a disaster. I mean, it's a really tragic story because in the 1980s, Iraq had one of the most, by official American government accounts. Iraq in the 80s was, after all, an American ally to a considerable extent in the struggle against the revolutionary Iran. But American accounts at the time credit Iraq as one of the most advanced Arab economies. I mean, it had a considerable industrial sector, relatively well-developed transport system, comparatively good infrastructure, quite modern healthcare system. It had a relatively large middle class, per capita incomes that were comparable to Venezuela or Trinidad or Korea, and one of the best educational systems in the Arab world. So, you know, Iraq was a success story, broadly speaking, in the eyes certainly of Western commentators. It was a command-orientated economy under the Ba'athist regime, and one that was shaped by the imperatives of the Gulf War, but not doing badly by any standards, heavily dependent, of course, on the state of the oil price, which from the late 80s onwards begins to crash. But the real disaster for the Iraqi economy begins not 20, but 30 years ago with the, you know, with Saddam's invasion of Kuwait and the sanctions that followed that. And really, Iraq's economy has been struggling ever since. There was recovery from the low level to which Iraq crashed in the early 1990s. After 1995, there's the UN Oil for Food program, which enables a sort of trickle of Iraqi oil to reach global markets. But then the invasion in 2003 knocks the Iraqi economy back by another 40 to 50%, dependent on the numbers that you look at. And there has been a recovery from that extraordinarily low level that Iraq reached. But it's been patchy. It depends very heavily on both reconstruction spending by The Americans, the vast majority of which went on the Iraqi security forces, which was in part necessary because, of course, by 2006-07, Iraq was in the middle of a more or less, an unacknowledged but nevertheless extremely violent civil war. Iraq itself has devoted its considerable oil revenue to reconstruction very inefficiently, with huge levels of corruption and massive dysfunction as a result of the divisions within the country. And then you have the ISIS shock and the collapse of global oil prices in 2014, which knocked the Iraqi economy back again, 20% for the whole of the Iraqi economy, 35% for the non-oil chunk of the Iraqi economy. So the Iraq's GDP per capita today is, broadly speaking, at the same level as it was in 2003, whilst the rest of the world, of course, has dramatically moved on, notably the countries that it was a rival with and a competitor of. So whilst Iraq was once upon a time a bona fide member of the relatively high middle income club, it's now trailing along at the bottom of that league, at the very bottom of that league, and the non-oil sector in Iraq is at lower middle income, like $2,500 per capita kind of level. It's now essentially a country with an underdevelopment problem, with a huge poverty problem, millions of people dependent on food aid, a 25% underemployment rate, 40% amongst young people who make up a very large share of the Iraqi population. It's 87% dependent on oil revenue for its government account. So basically, its ability to function as a political system, which is heavily dependent in the post-Ba'athist period on basically dishing out oil revenues between various factions within Iraq, because the state structure itself was essentially demolished by the Americans in 2003. That is part of the legacy of this war, too. From an economic point of view, it's just been catastrophic.
And were there any plans, as far as we know, in the U.S. or Britain or anyone else involved in this war about how to improve the Iraqi economy? Or it seemed to me, if my recollection, the assumption was just that the economy would take care of itself once Saddam Hussein was gone and that the oil would flow and everything would get better. But there was no one really taking these economic questions then seriously, it seems like, at the time.
This is one of the things we should get into if we do this as a special episode. But I think, a key element, this was true in Afghanistan as well, was that, Iraq was a much, much, much more sophisticated economy than Afghanistan, but it was an economy essentially centered on state structures. And so Bremer's move early on to de-Ba'athify the state structures, which essentially meant firing everyone from the public services, slashed away the structures of the Iraqi state that actually held the economy together. It was an economy based on state-owned enterprises. And if you demolish the Ba'athist state, you're not left with very much. And the idea then was, I think, that private contractors from the West would enter this market and it would become a paragon of public-private partnerships. But of course, those are a dodgy proposition. They're a complicated bargain at the best of times. That when you have a state as weak as the Iraqi state was, it's a recipe for total disaster and, broadly speaking, dysfunction. I mean, I remember talking to veterans of the U.S. military, at the time in the 2000s, people who had been with the American forces as it entered, bombed out Europe after 1945. And they were saying how humiliating it was that whereas in Europe, within a matter of days, if not weeks, of American forces taking occupation, for instance, of a German city, they would restore water supply and power because they understood that to be absolutely essential for the maintenance of public order and therefore legitimacy. In Iraq, essentially, this was failing. The infrastructure remained totally fragile and unreliable for years after the occupation and the overthrow of Saddam's regime. So Iraq regressed from being a society which in the 80s was an example of oil field development, not at the same level as Iran, because the gap between Iraq and Iran is, of course, huge historically, but nevertheless, an example of relatively rapid progress in the Arab world. And then, to find itself essentially in a situation of chronic emergency after 2003 was a huge shock.
Yeah, the more one gets into the details, the more infuriating somehow it becomes. But I guess I wanted to ask a final question here, a pretty broad one, I realize, which is, was the Iraq War a significant war? As I said at the top, only 4% of Americans say they even think about it regularly anymore. And of course, it felt so significant at the time. But was this a war without sort of the stakes of real history in a way for the United States. You know, obviously it was a voluntary war, so was it a kind of expression of decadence from the United States because it was outside the context of the great power conflicts that you alluded to that we're now facing?
I mean, I think that's probably a fair assessment. I mean, I would say to some extent the same about Britain, which was after all the major ally of the United States in this hugely misguided enterprise, and served as a very important fig leaf, I think, you know, in the coalition backing the war. It's striking, I think, that it plays a relatively small role in public consciousness compared, for instance, to Vietnam. The American losses in Vietnam were very much more considerable, and the public relations management was more naive, in a sense, in Vietnam. The American military allowed U.S. journalists to, you know, put these horrendous images of the fighting on the U.S. primetime TV, which was famously not what happened during the Iraq War. I think into the 2010s, it was still very present. But broadly speaking, it's hard to disagree with you that this was an instance of a war of choice, which from America's point of view was a relatively, in the end, small part of America's overall strategic vision. But I think one has to insist that from the point of view of the region, you know, if we're trying to assess the significance of the war, it's hugely significant. I mean, the modern Middle East is essentially the product of three historical moments, right? It's, or maybe four historical moments, right? The first is the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire and the creation of Iraq out of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire under the frankly cynical auspices of the British Empire, the, you know, Sykes-Picot Agreement, which carves up the Ottoman Empire in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. The next moment is, of course, the creation of Israel, and the third would be the Iranian Revolution, and the fourth would be this extraordinarily violent destruction by the US and its allies of Iraq, which was, after all, a key element of this very fragile and very dangerous picture. So the consequences have been huge. The consequences are spectacular to the West, for Syria, because the ISIS moment in the Syrian civil war is unthinkable, I think, without the chaos that prevailed in Iraq at the time, but also for Iran. I mean, if the aim of the game was to, you know, create a Middle East more shaped by the United States, the consequences have been extraordinarily perverse. And, you know, the current moment of the moment, you know, in which China is brokering a rapprochement between a quadrilateral, you know, between China, Russia on the one hand, and China superintending an Iranian Saudi Arabian rapprochement. I mean, this is presumably the nightmare of American grand strategy, and hard to imagine without the vacuum created by this policy, with the end result that America has, to a considerable extent, withdrawn from the region, which in the 70s and through the 80s and 90s was considered, you know, pivotal to American interests. So I think it's a huge turning point in that respect.
I mean, but what does that say about the United States as a historical actor that can sort of create history for others without even sort of creating any for itself? It sort of just like blundered into this region, changed it in all these ways you're describing, and then just sort of stops thinking about it and moves on.
Well, that was the observation, wasn't it, about the entire operation, that the Americans didn't appear. Many of the American players did not appear to appreciate the world historic cultural significance of the territory that they were operating within, right? I mean, didn't really understand that Iraq was a relatively sophisticated society and therefore hugely underestimated the scale of the resistance they would encounter when they destroyed the Ba'athist state. But, you know, setting that aside, also just didn't appreciate the sense that Mesopotamia was a cradle of human civilization. And so, yes, I mean, I'm afraid that seems a fair judgment on this episode. And I think even the relative lack of commemoration at the highest political level itself is telling, right? That even now there isn't really a sense of accountability. I mean, and it would require a fairly deep soul searching also on the part of important media, right? Who were part of the, to be honest, I don't remember, and maybe foreign policy has skeletons in its closet that I personally haven't had the time to excavate, but notoriously the New York Times, you know, was at fault, I think, essentially, for failing to provide a corrective to the drift to war in the United States. And it's clear, very least in the team in the Biden administration right now, when they came to rallying United Nations support for the stance they have chosen to take over the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that they were extremely conscious of the damage that was done to America's reputation in the UN by what turned out essentially to be completely misleading, you know, if not deliberately deceptive, information and intelligence provided to the world community by the US in ahead of the war.
Well, we've strayed some from the strictly economic questions, but I do think this sort of goes to support your point that in a way the United States could manage to afford this war, you know, in all of these ways, and precisely in the ways that we've moved on from it. It's a sign of how much we could afford it. Yes, we do need to stop here. Ones and Twos is written and edited by me, Cameron Abadi, along with Adam Twos. It is produced by Laura Rossbrow-Tellum and Rob Sachs. Our social media manager is Claudia Tatey. The executive editor of FP Podcasts is Dan Efron. This show is made possible through the support of Foreign Policy readers. If you're interested not just in Adam Twos, but news and analysis from around the world, consider subscribing. Ones and Twos listeners even get a 15% discount. Just go to foreignpolicy.com/subscribe and use the promo code TWOS at checkout. That is TOOZE. And listeners, as always, we love hearing your feedback. You can send us voice messages on the Ones and Twos homepage on foreignpolicy.com, or you can email us podcasts@foreignpolicy.com or tweet us. That's @onesandtwospod. Thanks very much for listening, and we will see you back in your feed next week.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries, or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.